got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here as always. Kevin, what's going on? How are things?
Oh, just counting down the days to the second shot. I've only been vaccinated on my left side, which means my right side is completely vulnerable.
It's exactly how that works. Yeah.
No, I'm trying to get my way to nerd immunity. So I've crossed, counting the days.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I'm glad to see that people are starting to get it, because I had to travel to another state for some family business yesterday, and you can see that people are just, they have pandemic fatigue, you know. They're like they're like in the casino chain smoking and pulling down their mask, and I'm like, this is just this is just not a good scene. So anyways, but let's jump into our stories for the day. So first up, COVID-19 vaccine success should prompt us to rethink our fear of so-called GMO Frankenfoods. Next, will 5G harm you? Activist groups are trying to stir up public concern as New York State debates the alleged risks of this technology. And then finally, human embryo research restrictions. Scientists now want to drop the 14-day limit on embryo research. So we're going to get into the ethical implications of that. But first up, Kevin, GMOs and vaccines. Tell us about this story.
Yeah, this is a really good story. This originally came from the Times of London, and it is, you've had the jabs, so what's wrong with GM food? That was the original story by Ben Spencer, who's their science editor. And despite my normal objections to such things, the graphic that goes along with it is a syringe and a tomato. And so I'm guessing they're injecting it with the COVID vaccine. So that's my guess. The whole story really boils down to the idea that could we be at a turning point for acceptance of genetic engineering technology? Because all of your vaccines are based on recombinant DNA technology. So Moderna and Pfizer use a recombinant technique to make RNA, which is then used in the vaccination. And the more radical ones are like the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine is a chimpanzee virus, which has been, which has been disarmed and now is used as a shuttle to bring in the proteins that give you the antigenic response. So these are all recombinant DNA technologies. And you know what? People are lining up for them and they're excited about them. And the acceptance is huge. And even though there are skeptics and hesitants and all these things, generally, we're in a really good place. And this has been of particular excitement for some folks. I know Fiona Fox, who was mentioned in the article. Fiona, she's the chief executive for Science Media Center. She said, you know, plant scientists have always complained that we had a different attitude about playing God when it comes to saving humans' lives. We're happy to mess with nature. And that's not an exact quote, but close enough. The basic idea is that people get creeped out when we play around with the genetics of food, but are pretty excited when we come up with solutions. And I guess the big deal is that it just is two parts of the brain, right? It's the way that you accept the science and are comfortable with the risk, that when it's medicine, the patient gets the benefit. Whereas when it's in crops, it seems like the farmer gets the benefit. So that may be the best way to figure that out. That was the synthesis from Chris Pollack, who oversees a lot of the GM field trials, or at least did during the Blair era. So, you know, this is where the article really kicks off, is that, you know, here people don't care about this technology as it's being injected into them. Yet they still have concerns about crops.
I was also really glad to see this article. And the primary reason is that I give the media a lot of blame for the fear that circulates about genetic engineering and pesticides and some of these related issues, because especially since the COVID pandemic, they've been, rightfully so, they've been harsh on conspiracy theorists, and they've been attacking people who are promoting nonsense about the COVID vaccines. But at the same time, almost literally, you'll see an outlet like CNN run an article that says, here's the latest Dirty Dozen from the Environmental Working Group, and you should eat organic when you can. And, you know, the EPA just refuses to ban certain pesticides that public health advocates, quote unquote, say aren't safe. And The Guardian as well, in London, they'll run stories, they'll get paid by animal rights groups. They'll apply for grants, and then they'll run stories that say, you know, animal agriculture is destroying our planet and your food's not safe. And there's implications about diseases spread, like viral diseases spreading because of livestock farming. So on one hand, they're telling people, don't be a conspiracy theorist, trust the science, follow the science. And then they turn around and they go, yeah, but you know, the same people that are responsible for your food safety, they're corrupt and they've been bought off by industry. And so articles like this, I think, really correct that imbalance. And it's really important to see more of that, hopefully.
Yeah, they really linus the whole situation, because, you know, he realized his own hypocrisy, right? That being in tune with science with respect to climate change, that when he would look at the evidence for genetic engineering, he couldn't help but notice it was pretty much spot on. It had nothing to do with big companies, you know, or anything like that. Just the science itself was good. And this is when, you know, you talk about pandemic fatigue earlier. The article goes on to posit that there may be something going on with genetic modification fatigue. They didn't call it that. But the idea that people care less and less about GM crops because they've been around for 25 years and no evidence of problems, but also that people are starting to understand that the risk is almost non-existent. You know, I mean, there's nothing that ever happens without risk, but it's as close to zero as you can get. And the evidence says not only is it not plausible, you know, not only is it, you know, they're unlikely that something would go wrong, there's no evidence that it has in 25 years and billions of meals. So it's that's another really important part of this article, along with the idea that, you know, Brexit now may be the way out, right? Brexit may be the silver lining the silver lining of Brexit is that Great Britain can make its own rules instead of having to follow the EU. So that's the other big one in the article.
And to follow up on that, he mentioned specifically that Greenpeace in the UK and Friends of the Earth, who at least previously were very, very active in the anti-GMO movement, they have basically said nothing about the UK's consultation process on approving gene-edited crops. And I think part of that is because, as we've reported on GLP, they've moved to Africa and they've moved to Latin America, where they're having a much more impact. But at least for the UK, that's a really good sign that the people that typically would put up the most resistance now are, they've just kind of moved on, or they're, you know, rearranging their resources, I guess is a way to put it. But I think even they sort of see the writing on the wall, not all of them, as, you know, we talked about that GM Watch webinar last week very briefly. There's still people fighting it, but their arguments haven't changed in 30 years, and they don't have the same sway as a big brand like Greenpeace. So I think that's a very good sign.
Yeah, and since so much of what they said and what they did and all their campaigns were really financially based, right? These are topics that we can use as fundraisers. They don't work anymore. No one wants to get money to these organizations who've been lying to them forever. And so now it's maybe good to back away from that, or at least introduce a new boogeyman like glyphosate. And I think this is just a tired out one. And so for every Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, you got Jonathan Jones and Maurice Maloney, who were both quoted in this article. And both of them talk about the idea that you know, at least, you know, Jones, he says that if there was a good thing about Brexit, you know, he says he went to every anti-Brexit protest. But here's a silver lining. And here's what makes Brexit maybe possibly enabling science to finally move in the UK. And Maurice Maloney, who was the director of Rothamsted, which is where they were going to have that, you know, take the bread back or whatever that was, protest about 10 years ago. He says that if you look at what the biggest contribution to soil health was in places like Canada, it was GE canola that allowed the low till and no till and conservation tillage for different crops, namely canola, where he was up in Saskatoon. But the basic idea is that there's fatigue because the technology has been beneficial with no risk.
Well, speaking of new boogeymen, let's talk about 5G. And I suppose it's going to, I don't know, give everybody cancer. And it's behind the coronavirus and all kinds of nuttiness. So tell us about this story.
Yeah, this story is from Jeffrey Cabot, you know, long friend of GLP and certainly been on my podcast. He talks about this in a GLP article that will 5G harm you? Activist groups succeed in stirring conspiracy health risk phobias as New York State legislature prepares to debate growing evidence of harm. And so there were bills that were actually introduced to the New York State legislature. And they wanted to have a special commission that would investigate the RF, a radio frequency microwave radiation energy that's emitted under 5G. And, you know, the idea is saying that there is some health and environmental impact. And what it really means is that we have to sit down and really look at, is there any risk associated with 5G wave bands? And this is what Jeffrey Cabot goes into. He's studied this and written about it quite a bit. I saw him give a great talk at the McGill University a couple of years ago too. But the bottom line is this energy, the wave bands used in 5G are really showing no more evidence of harm or any evidence of harm in legitimate reproducible studies. You can find something here and there in a petri dish or maybe a one and done study, but very limited evidence of anything reproducible or no evidence of anything reproducible that indicates that they would be dangerous.
That's actually a really good point that he makes, I think, because, and you know this as a scientist, Kevin, you know, you can get all sorts of studies published, but each one of them is very preliminary. And in many cases, as he says, they can't be replicated because they're not very good. But if you gather all that up and you do a meta-analysis or you write up some sort of a position paper as an activist group and you can cite all these studies, if you're a policymaker, you don't know anything about the issue and you see, oh, look at all these publications, you know, this must be really serious. Your case looks really compelling. And in reality, it's mostly low quality research. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. But that's exactly what they use to talk about RF fields. The idea that you could, make something happen in cells in a petri dish, you know, stop dividing or divide too much, and then extrapolate that to some sort of physiological harm. But those are never reproducible, and they're cells in the dish. Cells in your body have other constraints to control regulated proliferation. So and they also use extremely high energies. So because they're trying to find some sort of starting point to find effects of these things, they'll start with tremendously high energies or tremendously high durations or both, and then show some sort of effect that you would never see in real life, you know, under normal radiation. And that's the other thing, you know, the buzzword of radiation. This is radiant energy, but it's not ionizing radiation, the shortwave stuff like X-rays and cosmic rays and even UV, which have wavelengths that are in the order of cellular, you know, or intramolecular. So they're very small wave bands or wavelengths where the energies are focused at a very small level that can have biological consequence. What we're talking about here, when we're talking about 5G or other types of radio frequencies, you're talking about wave bands that are, you know, 80 meters, 16 meters, you know, literally that large. And these are wavelengths that are in the kilohertz. I think probably the lowest they use for these traditionally for 2 to 4G probably was in, I'm not exactly sure where it falls in the meter scale. I have a conditioning in this growing up because my dad was a ham radio guy, K9 QPJ. And we always had antennas and stuff. So I was kind of into antenna talk. But the deal with 5G is that the wavelengths do start to approach biological, in that you're seeing wave bands that are now like 10 centimeters to a millimeter. And so now you start to see, all right, maybe there could be something plausible here, because there are insects and things that have longer wavelength communication, and, you know, pit vipers and things. So so you do start to see maybe some integration of biology, which starts to make this plausible, yet that evidence isn't there yet.
It, just to give one example, last spring, I think it was, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and our friend Zen Honeycutt from Moms Across America, because they're really big into this whole 5G is going to kill your kids thing, they were going on about a study that was put out by the National Toxicology Program. And it's an animal model. And it, according to them, it showed that this radiation is very, very dangerous. But when you actually go read the study, which I had to do to write this article, it's, the evidence is contradictory. And they said this, they weren't, the authors weren't trying to hide this, but they said, look, some of the rats that were exposed to this actually lived longer than the control rats. So somehow that conclusion got turned into, well, some of the rats, you know, got cancer, and so therefore you need to be really freaked out. So they strip it of all context, and then they put it in a press release, and then, you know, you're Joe Citizen or Sally Citizen, whatever, and you read something like this on your Facebook feed, and you're like, oh my gosh, what are they, you know, why are they trying to build this 5G stuff? They're going to kill us all. So I think that's a pretty clear indication that there isn't much here, because if you have to manipulate what research there is, then you're not on solid footing.
Right. It's all based on the idea that there's no good concordance between different studies. And if you see marginal effects here and there, then they kind of have a regression to the mean, right? That you see little effects here and there that just level out over time. It's a lot like the glyphosate story. You know, you can always point to some study where it looks like there was the start of a statistical association, but it's not reproducible in the next one, or the next one, or the next one. So it kind of, you know, comes back with time. But this is even crazier, because there's no way plausibly that 5G radiation could interact with you biologically. This wave bands are too big. And people say, okay, yeah, well, water is microwave radiation. Microwave radiation affects water. Yeah, that's why it works. But it's not the same kind of thing. It's in a much lower level, and water is an exceptional situation with radiation when you move it in specific wavelengths. Long story that I don't have to get into here. But the bottom line is that this is activists now trying to get the legislature to start spending money to study this more carefully. Sure, we should always study stuff, but let's stick with stuff that's a little more plausible.
Yeah, I think we just, as a species, we just suck at estimating risk, you know, because if you walk outside in the sun, you're exposed to more dangerous radiation. And as is really well established, if you don't protect your skin, you could get cancer. And I'm actually curious how many of these people who are afraid of 5G go suntanning, or, you know, don't wear sunscreen, or, you know what I mean? I just don't see how people look at those two things and go, oh yeah, this one, which has minuscule risk, that's actually really hard to even quantify. I'm going to be scared of this one. But I'm going to go spend 5 hours on a beach so I can work on my tan. You know, I just don't get it.
Well, it's the devil, you know, right? But I think that, you know, one of the best examples of that kind of risk insensitivity that I saw was, if you look at the risk from vaccines based upon the numbers we've seen from the COVID vaccines thus far, your risk of dying on the way there in the car is 10,000 times higher if you look at all the numbers.
Yeah, it's. I actually looked that up just for something I was writing, because I was talking about, you know, do I need, I, like I said on the show, you know, am I worried that my kid's going to be poisoned by pesticides? So I just looked up fatal car accidents in the U.S. and 2019 was the most recent data I could find, and 36,000 people died in car accidents. And so just like you said, you know, I mean, we get in our cars every day and put on our music and just humming along, just totally oblivious to the fact that our risk of dying is exponentially greater compared to a vaccine, you know? So I don't know how to fix that. Smarter people than me have to help people understand risk, because I can't do it. But let's move on and talk about embryo research, which is both fascinating and possibly kind of frightening, to be honest.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I thought this was a really cool story because I didn't know about it before. And this is a story by Antonio Regalado, who writes very beautiful stuff for the MIT Review, MIT Technology Review. And did you know that there was a 14-day rule?
I did, yeah.
Okay, so I didn't know that. So you have this rule that if you play with cells in a petri dish and there you have an embryo or embryonic cells, you have 14 days to do what you got to do, and then you got to get rid of them, got to destroy them. Because they didn't want any human research. They didn't want research on humans. And so everybody was able to get these things to go faster. They've developed synthetic lines that grow even more rapid so that you could try to get your work done and under the 14-day rule. And all of this has been something that has greatly limited scientists and their potential in studying how stem cells work. And the International Society for Stem Cell Research is the governing body that provides ethical oversight, because we can't do stem cell research. Well, it's federally unfunded. So the U.S. government does not fund stem cell research. So this other organization oversees it. And they've really considered maybe it's time to change, and some interesting discussions around that possibility.
So there's so many avenues to explore here, and I have some things that I think are pretty massive concerns, or at least they will be as this technology evolves. But what are the benefits, would you say? What kind of a case would somebody make for why we need to get rid of this rule and why we need to pursue this line of research?
Well, what they talk about is that once you've started understanding something in an embryo, you want to keep it going. And that they quote one bioethicist at Case Western Reserve who really says that you need to study embryos as long as you can. And in some processes, they're just getting started at 14 days. And especially if you want to understand human development, things like autism, other issues that happen congenitally, it's good to be able to look at that embryo develop through time. So there's a lot of good arguments there. Also understanding the genes that are expressed at different times during embryonic development. And we can learn a lot from zebrafish, fruit flies, and, you know, other non-human animals, but it's not a human animal. And so how do you learn about humans if you can't do it? So this is where this article really starts to take off. How do we really start to have better ways of assessing risk or potential outcomes if we can get beyond 13 days.
So let me bring in just one issue, and they mentioned this in the article, that is, it's going to be really explosive. I don't know exactly when this is going to happen, but we're at a point now where we have artificial womb technology. It's still really rudimentary, but you can keep preterm babies alive, you know, if there's an emergency or something. So that timeline is being pushed back earlier. And now we're starting to develop technology that will keep an embryo alive in an artificial environment. So at some point, these two technologies are going to meet, and it's going to be possible to keep, you know, human life alive in an artificial environment all the way through development. And so you're going to get to a point where a question like abortion, and I just saying the word kind of freaks me out because, you know, someone's going to assassinate me, but you know, we're going to have to address questions like this, because as far as I understand, the primary argument for abortion is it's a viability based argument. And so if you can basically erase that viability line or push it back to the very beginning, you know, we're going to have to confront something like that. So I'm not asking you to take a stance on that, of course, but like, how do we address a question like that? What are bioethicists saying about that?
Yeah, I think it depends on the bioethicist you talk to. And it's a really tricky conundrum for me too, because I don't, you know, I'm not a big fan of ending lives of anything prematurely. But at the same time, if you have medical conditions that we can learn something about from human development in a petri dish, and that information can inform decisions or products or development of therapeutics that then can enhance human life, then maybe it's a good thing. And it's a really tough one to call, but that's why these artificial systems were created. And maybe some of these new synthetic embryo systems, where they really don't develop into an organism and can't, but they can become an organized blob of cells that's reminiscent of an organism's early development. Maybe that's where we really have to focus. But even then, there are people who are really against it. So I just thought such a cool article because of that question.
Yeah, it's really fascinating what we can do. And I remember like writers like C.S. Lewis were talking about this in the 1940s, you know, and obviously the technology basically didn't exist at that point, but he and other people were debating the ethics of this, and they were really spot on in terms of what they said we would be able to do at some point. It was all science fiction at that point, but the debate's been going on for decades. So I think it's interesting now that we're starting to see things materialize that have been talked about just as these crazy ideas, and the implications are serious. And just to give just one other example, because I think people need to think about these kinds of issues. So for example, if we can edit embryos to prevent diseases, could the government or some, you know, some institution mandate that people use the technology the way that certain jurisdictions mandate vaccines right now? Know what I'm saying? Because it's basically sure. The same rationale, but at this point, I would think this is much more invasive. If you're going to tell people, hey, you need to use this because you know your child would have a certain percentage of X or Y disorder. I mean, these are like, I don't know. It's kind of mind blowing just to think about that. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you can't get people to wear a mask to prevent transmissible disease. How are you going to possibly let them edit their kids' embryonic DNA to fix their cystic fibrosis? Now, if you're talking to me, that's a no-brainer. I mean, we are going to do anything you can to solve a problem for someone in the womb or in the petri dish at conception or a few cell stage. You know, if there's ways to get in there and fix some things, then I think that we should. It's imperative that we do, because we have the capacity to do it, then we should do it. But it's, you know, again, it gets into these funny gray areas, and I wish I had all the answers.
Yeah. And no one does, in fairness, but if people want to learn more about this, I'd highly recommend Jamie Metzl's book, Hacking Darwin. I actually had him on the show a couple years ago, and he kind of went over the basics, but that was one argument that he seems at least sympathetic to, is that, well, you know, I mean, if we're going to mandate vaccines, logically, if we're trying to prevent infectious disease or any disease for that matter, you know, why couldn't we make the same sort of regulations for technology like this? But I would recommend this book called Hacking Darwin. Pretty, very readable, and it's interesting. But I just think, like, the concerns about genetically engineered crops or, you know, the existing gene therapies, defending them usually starts with correcting somebody's misunderstanding of the science. But when you get to this kind of like transhumanism stuff and these different technologies, it really starts with explaining how am I trying to say this? So it's like, you don't have to correct a misunderstanding, because there really are potential risks if you use the technology appropriately. So it's almost like a whole nother conversation, I think.
No, I agree. It is so hard to wrap our heads around this kind of thing because of all of its unusual edges. And that's why I kind of listen more than I talk when it comes to these things. It's a lot like when we talked about the, you know, transgender issues in sports. There's no easy answer. And you just have to, you know, consult your higher angels and talk to lots of people and listen to lots of opinions and, you know, hope we do the right thing in the end.
Yeah, very good. Very good. All right. Well, on a lighter note, hopefully, who are you following on Twitter?
Well, you know, what I always like to follow is the Roslyn Institute. And I think their handle is Roslyn, R-O-S-L-I-N, Institute, I-N-S-T-I-T-U-T-E. Roslyn Institute was where they engineered Dolly the sheep, so the first cloned mammals. But then they've been coming up with great technologies over the years, and they've always been at the lead edge of some of the really cool innovations of genetic engineering. So definitely worth a follow at Roslyn Institute. What about you?
I am going to recommend people follow Ross Pomeroy. He is the editor at Real Clear Science. And I've actually recommended people follow RCS before, but I think you should follow Ross as well because he's a really good science writer in his own right. I mean, he aggregates that site every day. It's a cool collection of stories from all over the science world, but he often has really insightful commentary or just good analysis of what's going on in the science world. So he is at STEROPO. At Steropo. So follow him, and I think you will benefit from that.
All right.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there for this week, you guys. Thank you for joining us. We are on Twitter as well, at CamJ English, at Kevin Folta, geneticliteracyproject.org. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.